Blind spots.
Cloud of witnesses, lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, or the close girding sin, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. And the part of the scripture which we feel would be appropriate is the part that speaks of the close girding sin, a blind spot, something near to us that we overlook. Not all blind spots are necessarily sins, but we have these areas that are close to us that we overlook, and they may be sins or they may not always be sins. It was the consciousness of hidden hindrances that led the psalmist to say in Psalm 19:12 and 13, "Cleanse thou me from secret faults. Keep back thy servant also from presumptuous sins." We do not intend to follow any sequence in this discussion, so do not hope for any. Blind spots, wherever they may appear, are the subject that we intend to discuss. We only intend to start the list, and we hope that you will, in your further studies, enlarge upon this list. But I think a good starting place is in decorum. Blind spots in decorum. The temple of Israel was to be a place where the word of God was read and considered. It was to be a house of prayer. Now, this did not make it a sorrowful, dismal place, but a place where the best and highest thoughts of men were exchanged, and the hopes of each attendant were enkindled and refreshed. A house of prayer, where the soul came to commune with God, to praise God, to bless Him, to worship Him, to seek God's face. It was to be a place of higher fellowship and higher stimuli. But soon this was lost to lower fellowship and lower stimuli. People gathered there from force of habit. They listened to what soothed their conscience and tickled their ears. They praised their priest and blessed themselves. And God became someone very far away. The house of prayer became later the house of human interest. And at last, it became a place of commerce, a den of thieves. Creeping deterioration destroyed the purpose of the house of God. Ye are the temple of the living God. We are God's meeting place here on earth. Our lives must show evidence of God's meeting with us. When we meet together, inviting the Lord's presence in our regular assemblies, how should we conduct ourselves? What about the decorum in these meetings? Well, first, what do we mean by decorum? So we may have our definition correct. We mean propriety and good taste in conduct and manners and appearance. Does good decorum mean excessive formalism? No, it could. Formalism is not what we seek. Formalism has far greater dangers than even poor decorum. Decorum is not necessarily a blind spot, I think, with most of us. Nearly everyone at times will confess that they have a need to improve their decorum in the church. I know of one brother who had a passion for starting meetings on time and ending them by the time the clock struck on the hour. He was aware of decorum in just this one area. But to fulfill this punctuality, he developed a blind spot, for in starting and stopping on time, sometimes he would become overbearing and stern to the point of being even discourteous. Keeping decorum by questionable methods is not to be desired. Decorum must come from within, from self-disciplined and well-trained soldiers of the cross. When we have good decorum because someone forces it upon us, it is no longer a virtue, and it is virtue we seek. Our meetings are for study, prayer, and fellowship. Good decorum should contribute to better studies, more earnest prayers, and more spiritual fellowship. And proper habits and proper regulations are important. The first rule of good decorum is to watch the heart as we turn our feet toward the house of God to meet with His people. If we are tense, nervous, filled with care, filled with conflict and irritation, and who isn't at times, we enter God's house as a liability and not as an asset. Poor decorum, poor saint, and a poor blessing. We need to pause and look upward to God and ask Him to quiet our hearts and tune our spirit in accord with His. Will God help us? Of course He will. We never seek His face in vain if we do so sincerely. Time is our servant when it is properly used. Late arrival at meetings is poor decorum. Sometimes, of course, it is unavoidable. Sometimes. But often it indicates a poor discipline in our lives. Being punctual is a good Christian habit. Not to just slide into our seats before the meeting starts, but ahead of time to be there and ready. Being overly time conscious can be poor decorum. When the meeting doesn't close on the hour, sometimes brethren become very upset and irritated by reason of a few minutes. Either the speaker or the chairman is too time-consuming. This, of course, can be objectionable in large gatherings or when certain schedules have to be met. But I think in the smaller meetings, this should be of less concern. If we allow slight deviations in time to irritate us or to make us uncomfortable, we are losing a blessing. Then we must have good prayers for good meetings. Decorum and prayer may help us. Prayer is a sacred privilege, and we must exercise ourselves to keep it so. If our minds wander in prayer, why should God command a blessing for us? Deliberate thought is necessary to make our prayers effective. The best way to start the meeting is to sit down before or promptly when the meeting starts. Be ready to sing the first hymn, The House of God is a Place of Prayer. And sometimes I think we Bible students are prone to make it more and more a house of fellowship and less a house of prayer. Silent prayer, group prayers, prayers for one another should be taking place in our gatherings. Certainly fellowship is important and healthy. Exchanges between brethren in the intercourse of the meetings and after the meetings is stimulating. There must be time for fellowship, but let us make it a habit not to use the study times and the meeting times to do our fellowshipping. I'd like to briefly go over some of the instances of prayer in the New Testament, just to get an insight into the prayer lives of the early Christians. We all are familiar with the occasion when Peter was in prison, how prayer was made for him without ceasing. And we remember when Peter was released by the angel. Oh, he knew that there was a meeting held in a certain place, and he went directly to that house where prayer was being made that night for him. They were at a prayer meeting, and that meeting was lasting long into the night. And then remember Peter, when he was visiting. He was visiting the home of Simon the tanner. And he was waiting for his dinner. And he was hungry, but he didn't stay around the kitchen and become impatient waiting for his meal. What did he do? Peter went up on the roof, and it says he went there to pray. Of course, he fell asleep later. But here we get an insight into his life. When he had some spare time, he went on the roof to pray. He had a praying habit. And then we remember in Acts 15:23, when they had elected elders in every church and prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord. And then there was Philippi. On the Sabbath, we went out of the city by a riverside where prayer was wont to be made. Oh, dear friends, is there a place, is there a time in our lives where prayer is wont to be made? We should all have a place and a time where prayer is wont to be made. Then we come to another area to find a blind spot. From the days of childhood, we have been taught to say, very early in life, sometimes even before we learn to walk, Mommy and Daddy teach us the habit of putting pennies into the piggy bank. And when Mommy and Daddy see the little one doing that, they smile at one another and they nod. Their little child is learning the proper habit of saving. And when the piggy bank becomes too small, then the child develops and he opens a little bank account. And again, the parents nod and they smile at one another. Their child is learning the proper saving habits. And finally, when they develop to the point where they can perhaps even use some of these means to make proper investments, the parents feel that their children's education is very well rounded out in the art of saving. But now, dear Mommy and Daddy, how about the training that goes into learning how to give? Sometimes this is a whole blind area. Little thought is given to training the children to give. Oh, we train them to share a piece of candy and so on, but we're not as systematic in teaching them the wonderful blessing of giving. Just to save money, that's no virtue. Any miser can do that. But to save so we know how to give, so how we can use these savings generously to bless others, is the whole art of saving. It's the whole basis of saving. Just to save for selfish interests alone can be depravity. The old training many children had of putting money in the collection plate, they were given an allowance, and maybe on Sunday they would give a nickel into the collection plate. It was not a bad habit. I think it was a good habit. I remember we met showing the King of Kings films in one of the churches, and they passed the little plate around, and I observed some of these little children, how they each got up a nickel or a dime, whatever they had, and I was rather impressed with this good habit, even though we don't care for the methods pursued. But I think the habit of teaching little children to give is a good one in the church. The wise man said, there is that which scattereth abroad and yet increaseth, and there is that which withholdeth more than is meet, that tendeth to poverty. And let us not train our children to withhold and save more than is proper, but let us rather expend great thought and effort in training them to be liberal. The liberal soul shall be made fat. And we observe that the poor sometimes are more generous proportionately in their giving than the rich. The poet said, it is not what we give, but what we share. For the gift without the giver is bare. I remember reading a little incident that concerned a young boy's generosity. This little boy went into a bakery shop, and as they are prone to do, he had some money in his hand, and he asked the waiter there what was the price of this article and that article, to the point where it became distracting to her. He was taking a lot of time, and what he was going to buy was infinitesimally small, and she was at the point of distraction with this little child. But finally, when he made his purchase, he had 20 cents. And he bought one roll for 10 cents, and he gave her the other 10 cents, and he said, this is for you. And it turned a distraction, an irritation, into an unforgettable event in that little girl and that waitress's life. And I think that little fellow was well on the road to learning the art of generosity. Then we come to another area. In the Christian struggle, sometimes a gulf takes place between the word of profession, our excellent word of profession, and the deeds of faith. The Bible does not fail to mention the weak points of its actors, and we can be glad that it does not. But there was a man named Ezra, a devout man, a man with a mission and a purpose. He had a secure permission from King Artaxerxes to lead captive Jews back to Jerusalem with all the necessary material and the necessary gold and furnishings of this temple. He was to go back fully equipped to rebuild this temple. And then he found himself in a predicament. He had represented God so wonderfully before King Artaxerxes. But actually, when he faced the journey, he became apprehensive. We read in Ezra 8:21-23, this is at the point where he was ready to take his journey to rebuild the temple. He says, "There I proclaimed the fast at the river of Ahava, that we might afflict ourselves before our God to seek of him a right way for us and for our little ones and for all our substance." Now notice this. He says, "For I was ashamed to require of the king a band of soldiers and horsemen to help us against the enemy in the way, because we had spoken unto the king, saying, the hand of our God is upon all them for good that seek him, but his power and his wrath is against all them that forsake him." Oh, he had made a wonderful speech before the king, and he had represented God so mightily and so wonderfully. And yet when he was faced with making this trip, oh, he longed to have some army, some soldiers to go along to safeguard the precious gold and silver and temple material that he had with him. But he was ashamed to ask for assistance, and so he did the right thing in the end. He knew that the journey would be dangerous. He was ashamed to ask for assistance, and so he made his prayer to God. And they did get safely through on their journey. But here we see how sometimes we tend to do the same thing. We have an excellent word, and we in our groups, in our fellowship with the brethren, tell the brethren and we tell the Lord tall words, taller than our faith. And later on, we're a little bit ashamed. Self-confidence and bold statements, so highly recommended by psychiatrists, is not the Christian standard. You and I are not going anywhere on self-confidence. Jesus said very pointedly, "Without me, ye can do nothing." Then we come to the dark areas sometimes of our mind. Into every life, some rain has fallen and some dark days have come. And yet this is no cause to build monuments to our sorrows that bring tears and dismay to us and all about us every time we remember. The life spent in overabundant weeping is scarcely a life of acquiescence to the will of God. Tears, to be valid, must be spontaneous to the occasion of sorrow and not premeditated. Artificial tears, as artificial laughter, are burdensome to all, but true and spontaneous tears are efficacious in bringing comfort. And truly no friend is so precious as one who has shared our tears and our joys together. Look at the record of all the great characters who surrounded Jesus. Jesus himself, his tears are recorded. And there were Peter's tears. There were Paul's tears. Stirring sermons are in those tears. Those tears tell of great moments, great crises, great sorrows, and they also tell of great character. But from the dark corners of the mind sometimes come dismal attitudes and words. These words are intended to call attention to self unnecessarily, or even sometimes to call attention to someone else in a derogatory way, unfortunately. If we find ourselves receiving comfort from the brethren without going up out of our way to secure it, then that comfort is valid. But if we find that we are seeking, going out of our way to seek sympathy and comfort from the friends, then I think we should realize that that sympathy is not deserving to us. Then I'm reminded of another blind spot. There once was a good Christian lady who was very much like Dorcas, full of good works and alms deeds. And this, the time was after the war, and people needed clothing in Europe. And this woman, as we might suppose, was first to get the church ladies together, busy collecting clothes and sending them off to the needy in Europe. And there were many needy. But this was not all, this good Christian woman. She wanted herself to make a gift to the needy over there. And she had a lovely coat which she was going to send to some person in Europe. It was still new. It was a lovely gift. It was something that would be a valued gift on the other side. And she wanted to be generous about this. She didn't want to just give something that, no one else would wear. She wanted to give something good, and she did just that. She had it cleaned, and she had it pressed and neatly done up, all ready to send. And then at the last minute, her eyes fell on those gorgeous buttons on that coat. And so she reached for the scissors, snip, 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 and there went the buttons, and the coat went off without the buttons. Now, what good is a coat without the buttons? Oh, a lovely gift was shorn of its excellence. Now, here is a blind spot. How often we start out to do some good work and fail to go all the way. Somehow, we always manage to snip off the buttons. There was a volunteer captain once that had a lot of tracts at a convention public meeting. And in handing out the assignments, he was confronted with many volunteers. But some of the volunteers had this strange request. They said, "Well, we want to go tracting, but we'd like a territory near the hall." Well, that was fine, but how much territory is there around the hall, after all? Then there was a sister who took Brother Pilgrim to the station. And of course she got him there in time. Just time enough to run down the tracks and catch his train. And there went the buttons. There was a brother, Jehu, who was always good for a ride to the meetings and the convention. But his passengers sometimes arrived a little unnerved and pale. There went the buttons. And then there was the loving visiting brother elder who was always came with helpful talks. And he usually came inspired to give some helpful suggestions to the friends. Ah, but this time upon arriving in the city, some brethren in whose home he was entertained, they confided all the problems of the ecclesia, all the problems of the brethren in that area to Brother Pilgrim. And of course, wanting to be helpful, having listened to all of this, he feels that he must say something to help the friends out. And without realizing it, he finds that in this discourse, he isn't really being so much inspired as he is being catapulted into saying things that may not necessarily be true evaluations properly given to that group of brethren in that area. And so there go the buttons of fairness and honor. In so many ways we mean well, and we intend to do well, but these lovely buttons, we just cannot resist snipping them off. Then we come to another area, excuses. Are you in the habit of making excuses for the things you did which should not have been done? Do you excuse yourself from doing what ought to be done? Who does not at times? We all do a little bit. There is room for failure, and there is room for success in our lives. Abraham certainly had grounds for failure, for disbelieving God. God had promised much, but time passed and it became evident that God was not doing what he had promised. He could have said, and with some justification, he could have said, "How long does a man have to wait?" That would have been a good excuse. When he was asked to offer up Isaac, he could have said, "If I take Isaac's life, what then will happen to the promise that the Lord has given me of a seed? Anyway, I cannot be expected to murder my son." These would be excuses, valid excuses. But there was room for faith and success, and Abraham chose the more excellent path. The test with you and me is quite the same. Every day we can believe God, or we can excuse ourselves from belief. We can obey God, and we can offer up our Isaac, or we can excuse ourselves. But dear friends, remember there is a difference. If we take the path of excuse at the end of the way, God will excuse us from the reward we seek. But if we believe and obey and offer up daily our Isaac, the flesh of the new creation, our flesh, our part in that sacrifice, the Lord will be pleased. Then I have another area, a blind spot. An inelegance in hurry. All modern living is built around hurry. It is so much a part of life, even Bible students' lives are affected in the general hurry and bustle of our day. But remember, the meal swallowed in haste sometimes has bad after effects. The job done in haste often has to be done over, or at least improved upon later. The calculations done in a hurry stand in great danger of error, and the conclusions reached in a hurry may be deceptive, and the life lived in constant hurry may never attain its goal. Notice in life, however, how the lady who is always in a rush seems to have all the time in the world when she goes to buy a hat. And the man of constant hurry may sit for hours on the river's edge to catch a fish. You do not see him looking at his watch with anxiety, wondering where is the fish. He may spend the whole day without catching a thing, but he'll be back there tomorrow after his fish. And dear brethren, we may have to hurry a little in life, but as touching our devotion to the Lord and our service of the truth, let us be as the lady buying the hat and the man catching the fish, infinitely deliberate and patient. And then we come to another area, time which is too dear. Time clocks are common, and we come to think of our time in terms of so much an hour. A commercial value on our time may be fine in the world of business, but it is death to the good works of a Christian. How often good works and good deeds go undone because our time has become too dear. How much was Jesus' time worth an hour? I wonder. Commercially, he worked for carpenter's pay, which was not very much. And notice how God saw to it that Jesus was just a poor working man. And I say poor working man, rejoice, because this is what God intends mostly for his people. God did not want his son to live off the sweat of another man. When he began his ministry, he spent a great deal of time just walking from one city to another. He managed to get to the synagogue on the Sabbath, to Jerusalem on the feast days, to walk, to talk to the woman at the well, to suffer little children to come to him, to spend evenings in prayer, to minister to the physical needs of people, to minister to the multitude, to explain his parables to his disciples, to feed the throngs, time to consider the lily and the sparrow, time to strengthen his disciples, and countless other deeds. Jesus' time was so short so precious, and yet it was so available, so freely available to all who sought it. In our hurried life, let us find the time to do the good things we intend to do. Surely, you are not too busy to do good to your brethren. If your time has become too dear, too valuable, take heed. Then we come into another area. Words. Soft words and hard words. By thy words thou shalt be justified, by thy words thou shalt be condemned. Propaganda specializes in soft and hard words properly blended. Soft words appeal to our sympathies, to our devotions, and our ideals. Hard words stir up indignation, hostility, and prejudice. To the propagandists in one quarter, capitalism represents exploitation, imperialism, greed, ruthless economics. These are hard words. In the same area, communism represents equality, fraternity, social justice, and purity, soft words. In other quarters, capitalism represents progress, freedom, abundance, and opportunity, soft words. While communism stands for tyranny, slavery, poverty, and despair, hard words. These soft and hard words are influencing people strongly all over the world. And the art of using soft and hard words is not lost to any society or any culture. All use them. Unfortunately, for the most part, society has been misled through the easy flow of these soft and hard words. How artfully the educated tongue, and you know we're all educated now, can rend the character of another by employing hard and soft words. We use soft words to gain confidence of our hearers, to impress them with our purity and our benevolence. And then, with a few hard words, we lay our brother bare as a Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, or an Absalom, or even a Judas. Yes, and sometimes we even condemn our brethren with faint praise. The educated tongue knows how to say the evil word without guilt, how to incriminate by association, how to assassinate by implication, and how to isolate by default. This is the evil day. The powers of evil have never been so refined and so acceptable as now. And how urgent is the whole armor of God that we be enabled to stand in this evil day. Hard and soft words both have a place, but may they be employed to bless God's people and to destroy the darkness with light. Then we come into another area, understanding and expectation. Understanding, of course, having understanding hearts, are the ultimate goals for us as new creatures on this side of the veil. There is, however, an understanding of environment evaluation and a base acceptance of normal behavior that becomes a study of psychology. It's good to a point and serving good in many areas in dealing with human difficulty. We have no criticism for the good that has come from this area in helping alleviate some of the difficulties that men have in their relations with one another. But certainly this is no substitute for the Christianity of the Christ disciple. We find that God understands so well. He knows our frame, that we are dust, and He removes our sins from us as far as the east is from the west. He is full of compassion, full of mercy, full of forgiveness and grace. His understanding is so great that He even says that when our hearts condemn us, that He is greater than our hearts, that He can understand certain things better than we, and that we should not condemn ourselves unnecessarily. But at the same time, make no mistake, God is full of expectation touching your life. He expects you to grow up. He expects you to suffer. He expects you to sacrifice. He expects you to love righteousness. He expects you to hate iniquity. He expects you to increase your talents and your pounds. His understanding, please note carefully, does not interfere in any way with his expectations. What a perfect blending of understanding and expectation. And to be perfect, they must balance each other. God knows what to allow, and he knows what to expect. He knows what is excusable and what is not. He knows when to beget us with his Spirit, when to quicken us, when to seal us, and when to say, well done. He also knows when to take away our anointing, and also, if need be, when to blot our name out of the book of life. We have entered an age of understanding that minimizes expectation, and the world is sick unto death. True, the past has been severe, full of expectations and rigid disciplines based on fanatical and hypocritical standards. But what advantage is there in casting away expectation and calling for understanding to work the cure? Understanding and expectation are blended fairly well in the material realm. Employers try to provide proper equipment, healthful environment, adequate training to enable the worker to do the job. They allow for mistakes. They understand that man has weaknesses, but they still expect the end product. The worker is expected to deliver the goods. The same is true in school. The child is helped. He is trained, but he must meet certain academic standards, or else he fails. But morally and spiritually, no one seems to expect much. It is all understanding and environment, selfishness, lack of consideration of others, indolence in spiritual and moral search, poor spiritual discipline are all covered over with a mantle of understanding. This is bad for the world. It is dreadful for the Christian. The highest compliment we can pay in others sometimes is allow them to live up to an expectation. When father has trained his son, maybe a 12-year-old son, properly, the day comes when he tells his son, well, now you can go out and plow the east field. Well, that's a big day for that boy. He's properly trained. It's a great moment in his life. He is going to live up to his own expectation, and he is setting out to live up to an expectation that his father has placed in him. He has been trained step by step to fulfill this expectation both by himself and by his father. Another father may hesitate to send his much older son. Maybe he may even be a man, and he might have qualms about telling him to go and take the tractor and plow the east field or to do some other duty. The difference between the two cases is one man has allowed his son to grow into a sequence of fulfilled expectations, and so he develops, whereas the other had little expectation. And then maybe he made a great expectation all at once, which was too much, and he overwhelms the child and discourages him. But we are not here concerned with child care or world conditions. I speak of understanding and expectation in the church. Count that ecclesia happy who has learned to understand and expect in proper balance. It is happy when everyone in the ecclesia is complimented with a place and a function to fulfill, a standard to uphold, and a charge to keep. Is this not godlike? Is not God full of such expectation from each of his children? Indeed, God compliments his children with proper and timely expectation. I feel proper expectations are necessary, or they shall give way to indifference or unworthy expectations. Have you ever heard it said at someone's failure, well, what could you expect of him? Oh, these are cruel words. Wouldn't it be better to share the disappointment of the one who failed? There must be expectations of love. not demands. But we are all under a new commandment that we love one another as Christ loved us. We should find, and we should expect to find, love in our hearts for one another. And we should expect to reciprocate in this love. Brother Russell said, and these words are very serious, to feel even a coolness of sentiment in connection with the prosperity of a brother or a lack of interest in his welfare is a sign of serious danger that we have slipped from the mark, that is, the mark of perfect love. Let us be full of expectation each day, expecting to live nearer to God, to be more faithful in sacrificing the flesh in its interest, and more abundant in love. To start each day with such to start the day without such expectance is goalless. Count that day lost, where we started without any expectations with regard to ourselves. If we start the day without expectation, just write that day off as a loss, because it is meaningless. Oh, we must start each day with some expectation with regard to ourselves. And at last, must we not hold expectations of entering into the joy of the Lord, both for ourselves and others, at the end of life's journey? The heart panting for the water brook, is that not the panting of expectations?